Okay. Greg, can you mention iCare is having a coffee morning on Friday the 22nd of September in Old Flaherty's Bar, Main Street? That must be Boncrana, from 10:30 p.m. until 2 p.m. Pearson Port Road would be the left lane on the roundabout from the shopping centre, says a letter listener as well. Okay. All right. Okay. We're going to talk about World Sepsis Day, which is taking place tomorrow. And we have a number of guests in studio with us. And I think, with the exception of me, I think we'd all like to be somewhere else, wouldn't we, ladies? Is that it? But we're here. We're here for an important issue. And we do really appreciate you calling in. Maninia Bradley. Good morning, Maninia. Have I got the pronunciation correct?
You do, Maninia.
Maninia,
good
okay.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have you with us. Orla Noonan is Maninia's sister, who's also a nurse. Good morning to
good
you.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to have you on the programme. And last and certainly not least, Siobhan Kelly, sepsis lead at Letterkenny University Hospital. Shall I start with you? Because obviously Maninia's going to tell us her story and Orla's role in it. But just to give us an understanding of sepsis, because people hear this A, B, you know, and we have campaigns going at the moment where there's a lady in Derry that wants all pregnant women to be tested for it because of complications with her child. And then we've had the whole story the last year about, you know, younger children. I'm talking about something completely different. But anyway, do you know what? In some way, that demonstrates why we need to talk about sepsis. It's quite a severe blood infection, is that correct?
It's an infection. Sepsis is, you know, with the body's response, the body would normally have an infection itself. It may be, like in Manina's case, she started off with a sore throat. But as the body progresses, actually happens, the body starts to fight, the whole body starts to fight the infection. And in the process, it damages its own tissues and organs.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a really serious response to an infection.
And are there telltale signs? Because it is a life-threatening condition.
It is a very life-threatening condition. And in a lot of cases, there is telltale signs. Them being, first of all, people may have an underlying, they may think they have a kidney infection, they may think they have a chest infection. They're, you know, potting along, no more than what Maninia was. Maninia was out at work that day, came back in again, but wasn't feeling well. So some of the symptoms we'd see people with, they might have slurred speech, they might have agitation, you know, they start to shake, they're shivering, and within themselves, they don't feel right. Some people may be a wee bit confused, and it's not so much the person that's suffering from the sepsis themselves that realises they're confused, but it's their next of kin, whoever's beside them, and realise it. They will have aches and pains. They might be running high temperature. Their hands will be cold. They'll be pallor looking. Their colour around their lips may be a bit blue tinged. Their finger beds may be a bit blue tinged. One of the questions I suppose we don't ask, because we're Irish and we don't like asking these questions, is have you gone to the toilet a lot today? You know, have you passed the same volume of urine as you would normally pass in the day? That's one of the first things, because our kidneys and everything else, everything's going to the central system, to our heart and to our lungs to try and preserve our oxygen going to the brain and going to heart and lungs. People also, their breathing will get a bit faster as well, you know, to try to get the oxygen into the vital organs.
Yeah, okay. And I mentioned conflating is there's a certain element of strep that when it gets more severe can cause sepsis, isn't that correct? So that's a different area, but that's where I was sort of getting a little bit confused there. So, Maninia, can you tell us your situation? Or you were sick for some time or had an infection some time before you got sepsis?
Yes, Greg. I had a sore throat, as you do have coming into the winter. I went to the doctor and they prescribed antibiotics and a steroid, which I took for about 2 weeks. I then developed, I felt I wasn't getting completely better again. So I revisited the GP and they prescribed, I had thrush, which I thought was thrush on my tongue. So they prescribed the medication for the thrush. A week later, I still wasn't feeling 100%. Mm. I was cautious of a kind of a wee ball or something on my neck, my throat, which I had visited Orla, and we didn't think it was that serious. Went to the doctor, was going to go to the doctor the next morning. Now, I was with Orla at 6:30 the evening before, talking. I drove up to her. She said, right, make an appointment, go into the doctor in the morning, which I was about to do, but I took very ill at 9 o'clock at night. I was in the house on my own. I started severe vomiting and diarrhoea all through the night. Orla come off night duty on the morning. Now, I'm very conscious when Orla's night duty. I don't torture because it's busy. And she passed my house and I rang her in the morning and I said, did she go up home yet? And she said she did. I told her what was wrong. Do you want me to come down? And I said, well, do you feel you want to come down? Are you tired? And she said, no, no, I'll come down. And Orla knows the story from then. I really, after that, I got very agitated. I was taken by ambulance. I really don't remember much after
and
that.
And I mean, we're going to talk about Orla's role in this in a moment, but I suppose, I mean, what I might do is, well, I'm under the care of the GP and the antibiotics fix everything. And then when the course is finished, everything will be grand.
Yeah.
I think this is a reminder to sort of trust what's going on as well yourself a little bit, isn't it?
I never thought it was anything more serious than, like, it's winter. I was coming into winter. Everybody gets colds and flus, like, but you get on with your daily life and you might feel a wee bit tired, but, you know, you keep going and that's... And then this all happened, which was just happened so suddenly, with overnight, like. And I didn't, wouldn't, and I think if I didn't ring or... I didn't have anybody coming into the house because my son had gone back to work in Dublin.
Scary.
So I would have been on my own if it hadn't been for my sister.
And you were almost a wee bit too brave for your own good too, because you didn't want to disturb your sister.
I never do, and I'm very conscious of that. But with her working, you know, it's busy, but I'm very happy I did.
So Orla, were there a couple of little signs that you were looking out and sort of monitoring, or was it when the symptoms began to worsen that you thought, right, enough is enough here? Or did you suspect it could have been sepsis at this point?
Absolutely not the night before.
Yeah.
Greg, as she told you herself, she had the chest or the antibiotics. She said the lumps in her throat. I really did think it was thrush. She was on something, the right medication for her. She came up that night. She was upset in the kitchen that night at 6:30. She said, I'm really worried about this lump. And I said, it's your gland. I'm sure it's a sweat. Because you're not feeling well, it's probably sinusitis. And sometimes that antibiotic isn't the proper antibiotic. So we'll get the specific one from the GP tomorrow. And that's how I left it. En route to Letterkenny, she phoned me again. She said, now I have Augmentin here. Should I start? And I said, no, because you don't want to throw something else into the mix. We don't know what we're dealing with. And tomorrow we'll get the right drug from the GP. And when she phoned me in the morning, it wasn't even the phone call. I knew she didn't sound good. But it was when I went in to see her, I thought, am I overreacting here? I've had no sleep. Is she as sick as I actually think she is? Menina was moving house too. We just omitted to tell you that. So there was scanty stuff in the house. I went back up the road again and I brought down a stethoscope and a sphig. I brought down a thermometer and I brought down sheets and jammies because all her stuff was in Mammy's house. So that was fine. I couldn't record the blood pressure. I thought, again, am I tired? She was so agitated and her was her colour, the purple in this, you know, office here, Greg. She was mottledy looking.
Wow.
So that's when I rang Marie to come across, because Marie was with her. She's her friend and Marie was there the night before.
Angel.
And Marie came. I said, Marie, am I? Because maybe it's the nurse within you or it's the way we were brought up, the culture. You didn't disturb doctors unnecessarily and you didn't ring for ambulances unnecessarily. And that was part of our culture. And I thought, am I overreacting here? And I rang the GP and I spoke to the receptionist, explained Menina's symptoms. She said he would get back, but it would be maybe 12 o'clock. And I'm still thinking of, poor me, I need to go to bed at some stage here. So that was fine. I thought, well, you know what? I'll try my end. You do your best, your end. I rang into the ED and I spoke with one of the girls, Sarah, told her, and she said, look, Orla, if you're concerned, I'm concerned, and just go get the ambulance. So we did that. We got the ambulance and...
And we'll pick it up from there. But Siobhan, what was happening at that time? And I know you sort of ran through it at the beginning. What was happening over the course of those weeks in Maninha's body?
Well, I suppose over the course of those hours, her body was responding. Her body was going through an inflammatory process. It was fighting an infection, that basic infection. But then, normally when we have a sore throat, our throat and our glands and our throat will fight the infection in that specific area. But what happens in sepsis, the whole body starts to respond. It's a massive response in your body. You know, Orla talked about her colour there, her colour being like the colour, like a purpley colour. There wasn't enough oxygen getting to her tissues, to her vital, to her skin. Her hands was closed. Her body was in a shock reaction. She was shaking. She was agitated. There wasn't enough oxygen getting to her blood. That's why she, you know, she was agitated and you know, not feeling herself. And that's the response the body was going through. The body was actually turning on itself.
And in any circumstance, well, I mean, there's always some circumstances, but ordinarily, does the body find a way through that? Or is that
that when you have sepsis, it's very severe and you need help. Very yeah. seldom will you come out of sepsis. Sepsis is one of the leading causes of death in the world, and that's why there's a World Sepsis Day every year to create that awareness. So, and that's the reason why sepsis, and why we want to get the recognition out there for people to know the signs and symptoms and know to act quickly, because as Munina says, she was at work the day before. That night she got sicker as the night went on, and in the morning time at 9:30 she was extremely ill.
Like, you could easily talk yourself into thinking there's nothing going on yeah. here, yeah. that I'll go to bed and I'll be grand yeah. in a couple of hours, couldn't you? That's yes. that's the thing, yeah. you see.
And the fact that she rang Orla and got her sister, or got somebody, even to get somebody in to look yeah. at you, because you doubt yourself, you overdoubt yourself.
You, yeah. you ring someone, it doesn't have to be medical, just have somebody with you. Everybody knows their own body, you know. When something changes in it, they know, and if it's something severe, you know, just make a decision that you go for help, or you ring your GP. They're there, that's what they're there for. Look, take more care of yourself.
Yeah. And Orla, your journey wasn't, your journey wasn't over once you got from home to the hospital, because with the best treatment that could be provided, your condition continued to worsen.
Deteriorated. Just, I got very agitated. I was just... I really don't remember a lot from... I don't remember being taken from Letterkenny. I don't remember going in.
So you woke up next in Galway, effectively.
Yeah, and 2 weeks later or whatever, and they said, do you know where you were? Obviously, they were questioning me. And I said, yeah, I'm in Letterkenny. And they said, no, you're in Galway.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. But I woke up.
So who that best describes the treatment? Were you involved in the treatment, Siobhan?
No, I suppose.
Orla? So what was happening then? So you took Malinia to hospital.
Right.
And they start at that point, is it...
No, the ambulance crew.
Yes,
the ambulance
okay.
came out, and I have to say, the ambulance came in, made a quick assessment.
Mm.
She went into the ambulance, and I had given them the vital signs that I had recorded. They went ahead and did their own assessment, and her blood pressure was extremely low.
The roof. Oh, sorry, it was
blood
low.
Blood pressure
okay,
was in her boots, and her heart rate was fast, and her temperature was high.
Right.
So the three vital signs were elevated, and they automatically... you know, recognised this is sepsis. So they started her on the treatment then. They started her on IV fluids, antibiotics and paracetamol then to bring down the temperature. And like that, when Nina was extremely agitated still, she went on to hospital and Marie went with her to get a few hours sleep as I'm going back in the next night again. And to be honest with you, Greg, as Nina went out the driveway, I thought she's gone to hospital for 5 days.
She's on, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So I go to bed at about 2 o'clock, 2:30 for a few hours, get up again, and Munina had responded to the medications in Letterkenny University Hospital where she was. But at 6:30 that night, I was again coming back in again for my night shift. She went downhill, got very ill, and then she went into resus, and they attempted to, you know, get her all stabilised and drugs and drug resuscitation and fluid resuscitation. And she ended up going to intensive care that night. And as Munina said to you, she was complaining of this sore neck as well, because her throat then, it had become, and I'm probably skipping on because we never got a full diagnosis as to why Munina developed this, but they feel it was from a strep throat, strep A throat, right? So that infected her gland. So that's where the pain was coming from. And then Munina was in constant pain overnight, and she was in ICU, and the anaesthetist again and I were looking at her at one stage, and she came a little bit more mottled here, more purple here. So when they did the scans, they noted that there was an infection here somewhere. They weren't quite sure, and she just was deteriorating so much. They decided, she was seen by Mr. Sugar in the morning, he said straight to Galway. So he linked in with the guys in Galway, and she... after the results of the CT. So she got accepted in Galway, initially to cardiothoracics, but then they felt it was more vascular. So she went down under Mr. Hussey's team.
Mm-hmm.
But as the night progressed too, and we were following down later on that night in the car, she became so unwell. She was intubated and ventilated then in intensive care.
And you know, we're all sitting here and we're all thankful, Maninha, but this is very... this is traumatic, isn't it? And it takes a wee while to get over it. And it's like, it's kind of be ongoing, well, all's well that ends well, because this was a huge thing for you and the family. And you, I'm sure there's times you reflect and go, you know, get a gunk even just...
Just even now, like, just thinking back, when I came round in Galway, I was so anxious, just, I wanted home, you know.
So the care that was given in Galway, Siobhan, that was complications arising from sepsis or sepsis itself too?
It was a combination of both, Greg, okay? The initiation of the antibiotics and the fluid therapy and the supports for the heart and all that would have been started initially in Letterkenny. But because, as I said earlier, the sepsis is, you know, it's the body's own response to the infection and it starts to fight its whole body and it's damaged its own tissues and injuries. And it had damaged her tissues up and around her shoulder area and all that. And the tissues was dying and it was also a source of infection as well. And that's why the surgeries then were carried out down in Galway.
Yeah, and as you say, it's a very serious condition. 1 in 5 people who develop it die from it.
Yes.
But I presume counted within that 1 in 5 are those that don't get any medical treatment at all.
Not necessarily.
Right, okay.
Some people get medical treatment and do not survive sepsis. Mm. Other people have come out with life-changing injuries. You know, they maybe have left with body deficits or whatever, you know, defects in their body. And it has a massive psychological impact on people as well. And trauma post, you know, they talk about PTSD and from people who survive sepsis as well. So it's, no matter how you look at it, it's a life-changing event, even if you survive it.
So you talked Orla about a generational thing, maybe about we don't want to bother a doctor or we don't want to do this, that and the other. Like, I'm really concerned when we do talk about stuff that we're not discouraging anyone from getting help when they need it, because you could be of the view that there's no GP will answer a phone call and there's no point going to hospital because you'd never be seen. Yeah. So we have to counteract that and counterbalance that, right? What point do you, and either you Orla or Siobhan, then at what point do you say, right, there's a couple of markers here. I need to go and make sure that this isn't, because in your case, Monique, you had got antibiotics. You were under the care of a doctor.
I'd been to the doctor.
So what's the key from there? And I know we went through it a little at the start. Mm. What's the key from there to say, right, okay, I'm going to get this double checked?
Yeah. Okay. And I suppose I'll go maybe first.
Please. Yes. Go ahead.
I suppose Monique had gone to that GP, had got her antibiotics. Still wasn't improving correctly. You didn't respond completely to them.
Yeah.
And I suppose what I will stress is when you're given a course of antibiotics, it's very important to take the full course of antibiotics. Yeah. You went back to the GP again for review. He reviewed you. He treated what he thought was thrush, gave you treatment for that But you yourself, the person themselves, know them. They're not right.
Mm.
They're just not coming back to themselves. They're not responding as well as they normally would be if they had, if they had sore throats in the past or a kidney infection in the past. One of the things I will say, I suppose we have to watch our own bodies. You've said it yourself.
Yeah,
nobody
definitely
knows their body as well as you know it yourself.
Yeah.
And if you have that concern that I'm not right, go with your own intuition. Go with your own intuition.
Definitely.
You're better safe than sorry.
Yeah.
And especially if you've already had an infection. And it doesn't have to be a throat infection. It doesn't have to be a cough, a chest infection. You might have stuck with a thorn in your finger a week ago.
Yeah.
You have a wee cut down the side of your leg that you've passed no marks off. And then all of a sudden you might look up and say, that doesn't look too, or it may be something internally inside in your organs that you're unaware of that's causing the source of infection.
So what should we look out for then? I remember back in the day, my mother would check to see if a vein went red or something. I don't know if that was to do with this or whatever, but that's back in the day. So other than not responding to medicine, things aren't going as you would expect. What else you mentioned at the beginning? I just want to recap as we move towards the end of this. So what else might be happening
with
your body?
You might feel cold. Your hands might be cold. You probably won't notice the colour of your lips, but somebody else might notice the colour of your lips. They're not. Your breathing pattern will change.
Yeah.
You might be breathing more rapidly because you're trying to get more oxygen in. The also thing is you're not passing the same volume of urine as you would normally take.
Mm-hmm.
You feel tired and sluggish of yourself. Your concentration's not there. You know, you just... So some people vomit as you did. You vomit
diarrhea.
You're just not yourself.
Yeah.
And as Siobhan says, Monina mentioned about you know your own body, but who knows you better than the family?
Yeah.
Your family are a fabulous resource because they can say to you, well, Mammy does not look, I know her. They do know that person. They know when they're not well, much better than any nurse or doctor seeing that person.
Mm.
They don't know them.
Yeah.
So listen to,
and it can affect anybody. It can affect anybody.
Listen to your
family. Yeah. I suppose people who are well and fit, you know, yes, they can get sepsis. But I suppose people too with other underlying health conditions, young children especially, you know, all those things have to be watched out for. And they do encourage, you know, us all to get our vaccinations for the meningitis, for the pneumococcal pneumonias, for our flus, and those vaccines. While they may not prevent sepsis, they will help along the road.
Yeah, it's really, really important that we, particularly I think as parents, that don't get caught up or conflate conversations about vaccines, which we're not going to get into now, and then have a broader disinterest in them or be discouraged, because there are some that are long time tried and tested and genuinely can be the difference maker. That being said, it's up to each individual to make their own decisions. We are coming back into the winter again, Siobhan, and we are going to start hearing about strep again, and we went through this with our own boy there on Christmas Day. It got very sick really, really quite quickly, and thankfully we were able to get to NAUDOC and got antibiotics and everything was fine, but my word, it's not pleasant. So particularly for young people, because we talked about how we feel. So Maninia, she knew how she felt. She didn't want to upset anyone with it, but what about younger people? What should we ask where they can communicate, of course, as we head into to the winter season? Because it can affect younger people too, though I imagine it's rarer.
Well, it may be rare, but I suppose, you know, babies will go quiet. They'll not be feeding, like under 1 year of age, they'll not be feeding, they'll be very pallor. They will be what we call as limp, sleeping, just no life in them at all and that. And the same with young children, maybe under the age of 8, they'll be the same. Their energy levels will go down. They'll have no interest in food. They'll be crying. They don't want you near them. You know, those are sort of the telltale signs. Yeah. You know, and it's not, you don't have to be a nurse. It's a mother's instinct in a lot of cases.
Hello, over here, please. I'm a dad as well.
So, you know, those kind of things, you just know, they're not right and they're off their food and they're normally lapping about. Yeah. And children, I suppose what I will say is...
Wet nappies as well.
Yeah, and wet nappies. The nappies not going to the toilet as much as they used to, not passing as much urine. And children can get sick very, very quick. Yeah. They can be jumping on the sofa one minute.
Absolutely.
An hour later, they can be on the floor and lifeless. So,
exactly. You know, and don't think we're bothering people as well. I think we just need to make sure that we get help when we need it.
Yeah.
You talked about your interaction there, Order, with the blood pressure monitor. I think everyone has a thermometer in the house.
Yeah.
And should we all have blood pressure monitors in the house, I wonder? Because, you know, not even just for this, but more generally speaking.
I don't know, because what type of device do you have? Yeah, but I suppose it's a little bit about your ability to interpret the results as well and what you're looking for.
Okay.
I obviously, because my background's cardiology and I'd worked for years in the cardiac, I would have a spike and I would know a blood pressure
normal. Tie it in with
and I would know what was
happening.
Normal for Menina and I would know for... So you don't want to scaremonger people to go out and buy a blood pressure monitor. Literally, by me putting my hand on Menina's head was enough of a telltale to say that she is unwell. She was, you know, warm to touch. She was agitated. She was perspiring. There was a lot of other telltales. I put my hand on her wrist to do her pulse and I knew it was fast and it was so like that. The blood pressure I didn't believe how accurate was myself.
Okay.
So like that.
How are you now, Maninia? I'm sure you're grateful. I'm sure
I have good days probably, and most days I get frustrated when I can't do anything. Mm. I can't do what I want to do.
So do you still have a hangover from that condition, like in terms of energy levels?
No, well, I had my tips of my fingers amputated on my left hand.
As a result of this?
Yes.
Okay.
So things aren't as easy. I'm one-handed, more or less. But other than that, I'm keeping good. I'm in good hands. I'm still living with Orla. I sold my house. So I'm well looked after. Too well.
So is anybody looking for a lodger out there? You could maybe.
You're getting eviction.
So, no, health-wise. Yeah, I've got, you know, I'm... maybe get a wee bit more tired than I would have before, but no, I'm getting there.
Good.
Like it's down the line now and I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, and listen, it's about, with all things, I think, it's not about being fearful, it's about being careful, and knowledge is power. 13,000 patients received treatment for sepsis in Irish hospitals in 2021, the last set of figures we have. So it's not uncommon. But I think we've enough information disseminated right now that people kind of can be... I think sometimes we need to be entrusted, empowered to make the call. I think it's easier maybe to do it for a baby or a toddler than it is than it is for yourself.
Yeah. And I suppose also, Greg, if you look at the side of the national ambulances, our ambulances are on the road every day and they actually have the warning signs for patients to watch out for sepsis. Mm-hmm. It's on the side of the national ambulances as well. So, it's just to know yourself and know when to get help.
Yeah.
And don't hesitate.
Okay. Listen, tomorrow's World Sepsis Day. We have Siobhan Kelly here, sepsis lead at Letterkenny University Hospital. Orla Noonan, who is the sister of Maninia Bradley, who contracted sepsis, and thanks to the intervention of Sister and others and the great teams at Letterkenny and Galway, Monini is able to sit here and tell her story. Yeah. And the whole idea of it is to try and prevent someone else as best as possible to going through this situation, because it's
awareness.
It's preventable too. Mm-hmm. And the earlier, the better.
The earlier the intervention you get when you have sepsis, the better.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's, as a family, we wanted to contribute and to the awareness. And we
big time.
So that's it. It wasn't that bad, was it? In the end, like, this interview was all right. Siobhan's never coming back again. I'll be seeing you next year, Siobhan. Listen, thank you so very much.
Greg,
glad to hear that things are going okay for you. And it's clear the regard you hold your sister all in, and the importance she has in your
my life,
which is beautiful as well. So finally then, a very goodbye and thank you to Orla Noonan, her sister Moninia Bradley, and Siobhan Kelly, who's sepsis lead at Letterkenny University Hospital. And we'll post this separately as an item on our socials as well, if you want to share it with friends a little later on, because as I say, it's just good to have the information, and we kind of feel a wee bit empowered, don't we, when we think we know what to look out for and to trust ourselves and how we feel. We're joined on the programme now by Monsignor Anthony Figueiredo. Good morning to you, Monsignor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Buongiorno from Assisi in Italy.
It's beautiful to speak to you. The relic of the blessed Carlo Acutis is visiting St. Eugene's Cathedral in Derry, and there is a programme of events which we will go to. But perhaps maybe you might be able to tell us about the blessed Carlo Acutis, because he is special in a number of ways, not least because he has been deemed blessed, but also because of his age.
Absolutely. So, as you well know, when the church declares someone blessed, that's the first step on the road to becoming a saint. And the extraordinary thing about Carlo Acutis, who died at the young age of 15 in 2006, so he's the first person in the world to be declared a blessed in this new millennial. And being so young, he's attracting young people, young families. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. Wherever we go, thousands and thousands come wanting to know about this young man and be in the presence of his relic.
I mean, he had a big interest in gaming, technology, of course, all the stuff. Younger people now are still interested, and that's ever growing. But what was it about Carlo that he was designated blessed by the church?
Well, he was certainly a very normal kid. I mean, he came from a very wealthy family. In fact, I know his parents are still alive, and his parents never went to church, incidentally. Carlo brought them to church. What really made Carlo different amidst a very normal life? He loved sports. As you said, he was an internet genius. He loved video games. He loved hiking, swimming, had lots of friends. He was a good-looking young kid. What made him different was his passion for holiness. And so he had a consistent spiritual life, which led him to Jesus and made his life even fuller.
And
even
because of his background, Monsignor, would one have got the impression that this was something bestowed on him? It wasn't raised into him, but I presume people that have met him and have spoke of him and championed the cause for his canonization, there must have been something particular about how he held himself or presented himself, other, and we'll get to it, other than how he healed a young Brazilian boy. There must have been something as well about him that must have felt, you know, bestowed from a higher point.
Absolutely. And certainly the church has approved that miracle through touching of the relic. And that relic is coming exactly to your part of the world on Thursday. What is really amazing about Carlo is that we didn't know he was a saint until his funeral, because thousands came to his funeral. His parents says, we don't know any of these people. And it turned out that Carlo had befriended particularly the weakest members of society, immigrants, beggars, children who were bullied at school, the disabled. And so he had touched the lives literally of hundreds, if not thousands, of people and had brought them to know the love of God and the love of Jesus, which ultimately is what we are all called to. And that's what gives real joy to life. And we want to spread that message in Ireland. I mean, Ireland has such a great history of charity, of sending missionaries to the whole world. And now you've gone through difficulties in the last year, some come from outside the church, some which have come many from within the church. We want to bring Carlo to say, here's a young man like Patrick who heard the voice of the Irish people in a dream, remember, who said to him, we beg you, holy boy, to come and walk again among us. That's why we're bringing Carlo to Ireland. That's why we're bringing the relic to touch people's lives, especially young people. Imagine if young people today can bring their parents to church. I think that's going to be happening.
What can you tell us about the miracle which was approved by Pope Francis in 2020?
Well, again, extraordinary. As you know, the church has great precision in approving miracles.
Well, you have to, don't you? Because you can't, you know, for obvious reasons, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So this particular miracle, the parish priest came from Brazil, was visiting Assisi, where I am now. He left an image of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the home of Carlo. And the parents gave him a small piece of the cloth that covered Carlo when he was exhumed from the grave in Assisi, beginning his process of canonization. The priest took the relic back to his parish. That's exactly what we're going to be doing, coming to Ireland on Thursday. And in a service, the priest had many parishioners come and said, with faith, touch this relic and you can be healed. A little boy called Matthias, he was not even 5 years old, I believe, but he was unable to keep any food down. So he was wasting away completely, no cure whatsoever. His granddad brought him to the church that day. He touched the relic, and on his way home, he asked his mother, I want steak and chips, just like my two brothers. And when he arrived home, he ate the whole meal, able to keep all the food within him, and is now a normal kid. Doctors have said that's an absolute miracle. By the way, we also have a second miracle, we believe, in Florence now. We don't give the details of that. It's still going through the process of being examined very carefully. But Blessed Carlo of Assisi, and I want your listeners to know this, is a young boy who we believe is alive in heaven. And by bringing the relic to you, come, pray with him, come, touch his relic, and you too can receive a grace, a miracle, perhaps in your body, even more importantly, in your spirit. I just think so many people suffering today are from loneliness, from addictions, perhaps suicidal thoughts, whatever the situation is, we can be touched in our spirit and again know that God is powerful and God works miracles.
This is a first class, as it's described, relic. That means it's actually part of Blessed Carlo of Assisi's body.
Absolutely. And it's a particularly important relic. It's what we would say is a major relic because it's actually a piece of the pericardium. That is the membrane that surrounds the heart. So this piece of the pericardium of Blessed Carlo Acutis will be in St. Eugene's Cathedral, Derry, on Thursday. It's a very important relic. In fact, it's just been throughout the United States of America in many dioceses. It went to World Youth Day in August, where literally thousands of young people venerated the relic. And now, with the Archbishop of Assisi, we are traveling to Ireland tomorrow evening, in fact, to bring the relic to Derry, but also to Sligo, to Knock, and to Newry. We're very excited, and we really want everyone who is listening to come and pray before this relic.
And finally, Monsignor, almost finally, have you travelled with the relic previously?
Absolutely,
I have travelled with the relic. I beg your pardon, sorry to interrupt you, Monsignor. The follow-on question would be, you witnessed people in their numbers, but did you see any, I don't know if the right word is transformations or some of that that connection with it that you talked of, either physically or spiritually?
I can say with absolute certainty that I witnessed miracles, and I've heard of people really being healed in their body since our visit to Armagh, where perhaps 7,000 people came in the space of a day and a half, then West Belfast. Even more importantly, and I would stress this, I have heard of people who have been given courage and fortitude to go forward in their lives, especially young people, young couples, anyone who is sick, anyone who is disabled, anyone who is lonely. They know they have a young saint in heaven praying and interceding for them, who's walked amongst us. This is the great thing of Blessed Carlo Acutis. He died in 2006. So he knows our challenges. He knows our difficulties. He knows our sufferings because he's lived through them with us. He's a modern day saint, and he will intercede for you in heaven. Yes, I've seen miracles, and we will see them again in these days. I can assure you of that.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. Afterwards, I shall go through how people, what's going to be happening. But thank you for now, Monsignor. I appreciate your time.
God bless you. Every blessing to your great radio station.
Thank you very much indeed, Monsignor Anthony Figueredo. Relic, and it is a special relic, top-class relic, a first-class relic, that is. The relic of Blessed Carlo Acutis is visiting St. Eugene's Cathedral in Derry. The programme is as follows. 9.30 a.m. on Thursday the 14th of September, the arrival of the relic to St. Eugene's Cathedral. 10 a.m. Mass with Bishop McKeown, Archbishop Sorrentino and Monsignor Figueredo, which you've just heard of. 12 noon, Rosary in the Cathedral. 3 p.m., Divine Mercy. 4 p.m., Benediction, followed by closing ceremony and farewell. We're told this will be an opportunity to be blessed with the relic. Also, there'll be an exhibition of Blessed Carlo's life on display in the Cathedral Hall. The relic will then depart St. Eugene's Cathedral for Knock Shrine, where it will be on display on Friday the 15th of September, followed by a visit to St. Anne's Church, Sligo, on Saturday the 16th of September, and finishing in Newry Cathedral on Sunday the 17th of September. Everyone's welcome, they say, to come to St. Eugene's Cathedral for what's being described as a very special day on Thursday. I mean, you heard from Monsignor Figueredo there. I'm sure there are things that have happened, but I mean, obviously, people can't go up there thinking it's going to fix everything for everybody. But be that as it may, we thought it important to bring you that information. Okay, we're joined on the programme now by Tim Cullinan, President of the IFA, a very busy man, of course. Tim, thank you very much for your time today.
Not at all, anytime.
Right, so what went on yesterday? Were you offered a meeting, a one-on-one meeting with Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnell? Did you turn that down in favour of protesting outside the Fianna Fáil thinking? And if so, why?
No. Yeah, I suppose, look, and this reverts back just quickly back to last Thursday and I suppose even prior to that. And the reason we are protesting currently is, I suppose, look, obviously there's two key issues out there. And number one is the delay in the payments. Farmers have to wait in excess of a month longer this year for their payments, you know, which they're entitled to. Is any other factor in society, if they had to wait a month for their salary, I think there would be uproar. And the other one, obviously, is this whole nitrates derogation and what has happened there. And I suppose what happened was there was negotiations going on to hold this at 250 kilos organic N per hectare, and our proposal to reduce it to 220, and obviously we want to maintain it at the 250. So there was a technical water quality group set up by the minister. There was negotiations going on there. I was speaking over and back to the minister, and he was going to have this famous meeting with the commissioner that deals with this in the EU. And as we all know, this transpired that it was only a video call. You know, it wasn't actually an in-person meeting.
What's your concern with that? Are you concerned that the other party's not going to take it too seriously here? I mean, it can't be that big a deal if the last content before it's announced or the last contact before it's announced is over a video call. Is that what you're concerned? Yeah, Do you believe the minister should have flown out? No.
I just want to lead up to that. Look, and that's just part of it. But the key and substantial part of this is the way this was dealt with. So on that meeting, the commissioner told our minister that he was not going to continue with the 250, and the minister himself decided then that he was not going to make any changes or improvements in the days or the times of the farm payments, farmers getting their money. So what he did was he actually issued, and he had committed he would come back to myself on this, but what he did was he issued a press release on both and then put out a notice after the press release going out into the public domain, issued a notice for a meeting. Now, there's not much point in having a meeting when you have your decision made, this is what I'm doing. There was no point in having a meeting to discuss this. So that's why we were outside Kildare Street, our agriculture house, last Thursday. And following on then, you're right, the minister requested a meeting again with myself yesterday. And I was very clear, there was no point in having a meeting in the current circumstances. And our members were very, very clear. They were clear to me that they didn't want a meeting with the minister. Okay. So
well, with that in mind, and then securing a meeting with effectively Minister McConnell's boss in Micheál Martin and thrashing it out with him, does that mean you've lost faith in the minister to deal with him directly, that you want his superior in on the conversation as well? Because that's what it sounds like.
Well, look, my concern here is number one, and look, it's nothing personally with Charlie McConnell. Look, the man has a job to do, no more than I have a job to do myself, but it's the position. And all I want is that the minister, you know, he was elected to represent the people, and in this instance, he was elected Minister for Agriculture, that he would represent farmers. And look, I'll be straight and honest with the people there. You know, I believe that is not happening in this case, where farmers have to wait an extended period of time for money that is due to them. It's part of their salary. And obviously, the nitrate derogation and the potential damage this will do. What this means, in factual terms, a farmer with 48 dairy cows would have to reduce to 42. Like, this is, and a farmer with 100 cows, it would mean, if that farmer reduces 15%, in just sales coming into the farm, it would cost that farmer anything between 30 to 40,000 per year. This is the relevance of this. This is very serious.
And then there's other consequences it has in terms of land value and acquisition and all that, and even smaller farmers who might be borrowing against, you know, their prospective incomes. It's going to affect an awful lot of people in different ways. But just to be clear, this reduction in the drop in nitrogen per hectare is off the back of water quality. I presume we accept the findings of that. Are we satisfied that it is actually the farmers that are contributing to this poor water quality? Because it's certainly only the farmers that are being punished. So are we able to ascertain, when we have polluted water, that it is actually the agricultural community that's doing it, and not a quarry, or not sewage, or not Irish Water not investing in a particular area? Are we satisfied that it is actually farmers that are causing this pollution in our waters?
Yeah, and what is happening here is, and in IFA, we have contracted in the services of a hydrologist, a water quality expert, to look at all of this. And, you know, we have a lot of expert people within our staff ourselves. And if you look at it, 43% of the eutrophication, or the pollution in the bays, is coming from water treatment plants, which is not agriculture. And we accept there's another 40% coming from agriculture. But if you look at the map of Ireland and look at the size of farmland, right? But our point, to deal with our 40%, we have adopted 30 measures since 2018. We've reduced the use of chemical fertilizer by 15% last year. And currently for this year, we're down with a reduction of another 15% as well. And what's so frustrating for me is we've done all of this work, and we've put a very credible proposal to this minister to take to the EU Commission. Basically, in layman's terms, what the proposal is, that if a farmer wants to continue at his 250 or her 250 kilos organic N per hectare, that it would reduce the volume of inorganic or chemical fertilizer that farmer is using, which will alleviate any loss of nitrogen into the water course as well.
But Charlie McConnell Logan, in his press statement, has said clearly that this is not a decision that the EU and those responsible for it are going to change, that this cannot be forward. It's a fait accompli. The only fight now is to retain our derogation at 220. Or retain it at all, for that matter. That's the Minister for Agriculture's firm position, because I read it in his statement on the website.
Yeah, and that's why we are still outside the Horse and Jockey Hotel here in Limerick today, and that's why we will be at the Fine Gael think tank in Limerick on Friday. But the final point I want to make on this is, there's a lot of talk currently in media circles that, you know, there's only one or two countries have this special arrangement of a derogation. But if we look at currently what's happening in the Eastern European bloc, a number of the countries like a large country like Poland, Romania, and any of the countries that are adjacent or joining Ukraine have a special deal on grain that they do not have to purchase the grain coming out of the Ukraine, even though we're all in the single market. So I would have to beg the question, the people that we are sending out now to negotiate on behalf of us here in Ireland, are putting enough of pressure on the people in Brussels to maintain what we believe we need to protect 170,000 jobs up and down country of Ireland.
Look, there's other countries get different derogations on different things as well. So that's point's been well made on this programme at the very least, Tim. Whatever about anywhere else. Finally, I was going to ask you straight up here. You know the minister's position. You went above his head and wanted to speak to Tánaiste Micheál Martin. There's a line, you've got some time frames as it relates to payments. I'm not sure if you're satisfied with them or not, but I don't have time to ask you. I'll ask the question once again. As it stands at this point, do you have faith in the Agriculture Minister?
Look, that's a decision for the Fianna Fáil party themselves. That's not my decision, number one. And anyway, all I'm saying is, absolutely, I want to work with this minister, but he needs to deliver for farmers. All I say is, we're not seeing that delivery we require currently. And, you know, there's a few things the minister needs to do here. He can do them. He needs to go back and put pressure on in Europe and ensure we can maintain this derogation. And he needs to press the button, press send. You have ANC, which will impact seriously on a lot of your listeners up in County Donegal, and he could do that today. There was no change in this. I don't accept his what he's saying around the new IT system has to be built and all the rest of it. There was absolutely no change in the ANC payment, and I'm asking the minister at this late stage that he press the button and get that money out this week out to farmers.
Tim, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Tim Cullinan, President of the IFA. Have a lovely Tuesday. Back with you tomorrow morning at 9. John Breslin is next.